as I've mentioned yesterday, each day, the session after lunch, the 2 o'clock session, we're going to move into what's called the compassion wing of the practice. The reason being is that, particularly in a practice as shamatha, as this practice here, if we simply engage in this in a very intensive way, we can become quite unbalanced because we can become quite self-absorbed and very disconnected, because we can use this practice as a way of withdrawing from all of that mess out there. So this is not a very healthy approach to the practice. So we need some balance in the practice, and that means to balance this practice with the compassion wing of the practice. And in the compassion wing of the practice, we often talk about what's called the four immeasurables. These are four qualities that we are trying to cultivate to stay connected in the world. And they are loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So these four qualities we're going to be looking at over the coming days in this 2 o'clock session, and we'll be practicing those practices as well. And so therefore, we can gain some balance in our shamatha practice and balance it. And also these four qualities also can provide us a lot of fuel for the shamatha practice as well. So today we're going to begin by looking at the first of the four, and that is loving kindness. And loving kindness in Sanskrit is maitri, and in Pali is metta. And loving kindness here is simply defined as the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Or another way of saying that is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness and its causes. Now, of course, we all want to be happy, but unfortunately we're not often very clear about what is happiness and what are the causes of happiness. So even though we all want to be happy, we end up doing things that are heading us in the opposite direction. And that comes a little bit from the understanding that we can actually talk about two types of happiness. There's what's called temporal happiness. Temporal happiness is another name for, of course, pleasure. So this, of course, is the happiness that we receive from some sort of stimulus-based experience. We have some sort of stimulus, and then we have some pleasurable experience. And so we often identify happiness with pleasure. And as the name suggests, temporal happiness, this is a happiness that is a stimulus-based happiness. It requires some sort of stimulus for us to have this experience. And very often this is what we equate as happiness, these sort of pleasurable experiences. And because it's a stimulus-based happiness, the stimulus often comes from outside of ourselves, and so therefore what we tend to do to try to get as much of this sort of happiness as possible is we try to get those stimulus. And so as we saw in this morning's meditation, one of the main methods we use then to try to find this happiness is we try to manipulate the things around us. We try to, in particular, attract people, places and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And of course, the opposite is we try to push away or avoid people, places and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. So we end up in this sort of manipulation game, trying to attract pleasurable things, trying to push away or avoid unpleasant things. And of course, we often engage in this sort of method, and we've been engaging in this method for a long time, but we still seem not to be finding that real happiness, and we still seem to be encountering suffering. And so the more that we go into this approach, actually the further away that we get from happiness, because we just get ourselves trapped in this hope-fear cycle. We just end up hoping for pleasant experiences and fearing and worrying about unpleasant experiences. And of course, if we don't get the things we want, we often become very frustrated. Even if we do get the things we want, they never really fully satisfy us. We simply end up craving for more, 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 more. We're never satisfied. And then often, of course, together with that, we have a lot of dissatisfaction and disappointment when things don't live up to our expectations. If we are pinning our hopes of happiness on getting as much pleasure as possible, then not only won't we have a fulfilling life, but we're going to induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. And this is very much highlighted by a great Indian master, Buddhist master from the 8th century, Shantideva, who talks about this. He says, "Those seeking to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own misery. And with the very desire for happiness, out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were the enemy." So, therefore, I think if we really want to wish ourselves and others happiness and causes of happiness, we need to really understand the second type of happiness. And that is what's called genuine happiness. And genuine happiness is a state of happiness or well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. So it's not a stimulus-based happiness. It's an inner sense of happiness or well-being that really comes from being in harmony with reality. And so this is something much more stable, of course, and something that we can really strive for. So if we can be aware of this genuine happiness, and then rather than looking for happiness out there, we can turn our attention inwards and seek happiness within ourselves, then we can really develop loving kindness for ourselves and others. And so this genuine happiness is more about transforming our mind, of course, developing the mind. And the basis for that, of course, is this shamatha practice. If we can really develop this calm, clear, focused mind, then already our mind is much more in balance. And then on that basis, we can develop our inner qualities and we can really come to realize this nature of reality and thereby really find this genuine happiness. So if we really want to cultivate loving-kindness, particularly for ourselves and others, then we need to really reprioritize our life and stop looking for happiness out there and turn our attention inwards. Otherwise, we're just going to continue to have a lot of unnecessary suffering. Now, with this loving-kindness here, as one of the four practices that we're going to look at, loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity, these come within what's called the four immeasurables. And these are qualities that we're trying to develop towards everyone. That's what the word immeasurable means. The word immeasurable means towards immeasurable sentient beings, means towards everybody, to all living beings. We're trying to cultivate these qualities. So immeasurable loving kindness is simply the wish for all living beings to have happiness and its causes. Now, generally in the cultivation of this, it's recommended that we do this in stages. That in the text, normally it says, first we cultivate loving kindness towards the so-called friend, people who are close to us, because that's easiest. Once we're comfortable developing loving kindness towards the friends, then we extend it out to people we don't know very well, the so-called strangers, and start cultivating loving kindness towards these people. And then once we're comfortable with that, we start expanding out to people we find a little bit difficult, and maybe even then eventually people we don't like very much at all, the so-called enemy. So generally in the text it says we should cultivate towards friends first, and to the stranger, to the enemy, and then expand it out to all living beings. But I think in our modern society we need to add an extra step at the very beginning, and that is to cultivate loving kindness toward ourselves. Because unfortunately in our modern society there seems to be an epidemic of this low self-esteem and self-hatred. We're not very kind and compassionate towards ourselves, and so that's where we need to begin. Because if we're not kind and compassionate toward ourselves, then we're not going to be able to extend it out to others. So, of course, as part of developing this loving kindness towards ourselves, then we need to be aware of these two types of happiness, and instead, and rather than stop looking out there and craving more and more pleasure, we need to turn our attention inwards. We need to prioritize our life. We need to develop our inner qualities if we really want to be kind toward ourselves. So that's what we're going to be doing now is the meditation. We're going to do a little loving kindness practice toward ourselves. But before we begin that, I'd like to read a little bit about the practice here, because also in the Tension Revolution here, Alan Wallace has a chapter on each of these four immeasurables. And so he discusses this a little bit on page 23, and he says the following. With all the demands upon our time, the prospect of taking more time from the day to devote to meditation can appear to be just one more burden. But I would claim that the reason so many people find no time to meditate is not that they're too busy. We're all doing something each minute of the day, no matter how busy or leisurely our lives may be. How we fill our days is simply a matter of our priorities. It's only common sense to place a high priority on our survival, making sure that we have sufficient food, shelter, clothing, and medical care, and that our children receive the best education possible. To use an educational metaphor, tasks fulfilling those basic needs are, quote, required courses of action, and everything else we do consists of, quote, electives. What elective activities fill the moments of our days depends on our values. Another way of saying this is that after taking care of our basic needs, the rest of our time is devoted to fulfilling our heart's desires. We may envision this as the pursuit of happiness, fulfillment, or a meaningful life. However we conceive of the purpose of our lives, it will focus on people, things, circumstances, and other more intangible qualities that bring us satisfaction. You have already been alive and pursuing happiness for decades. Pause for a moment and ask yourself, how much satisfaction has your life brought you thus far? Many of the greatest thinkers throughout history, from Saint Augustine to William James to the Dalai Lama, have commented that the pursuit of genuine happiness is the purpose of life. In making this remarkable claim, they are obviously referring to something more than the pursuit of mere pleasant stimulation. They have in mind something deeper, a more abiding and authentic well-being that comes from within. genuine happiness is a symptom of a balanced, healthy mind, just as a sense of physical well-being is a sign of a healthy body. Among modern people, the notion is prevalent that suffering is inherent in life, that it is simply human nature for us to experience frustration, depression, and anxiety. But our mental suffering on many occasions serves no good purpose at all. It is an affliction with no benefit to us. It is just a symptom of an unbalanced mind. In our pursuit of happiness, it is vital to recognize how few things in the world we are subject to our personal control. Other people, that is, family, friends, busy colleagues and strangers, behave as they wish in accordance with their own ideas and aims. Likewise, there is little we can do to control the economy, international relations, or the natural environment. So if we base our pursuit of happiness on our ability to influence other people and the world at large, we are almost certainly doomed to failure. What can we control? What freedom do we really have here and now? Our first act of freedom should be to choose our priorities wisely. And then down the bottom of page 25. To bring all this back to the central theme of this book, one major impediment to training attention is not finding the time to do it. And the reason we don't find time to meditate is because we are devoting so much time to other priorities. Some of these priorities center on our basic needs, but many are wrapped up in craving in the sense described above. In desiring the symbols of the good life, that is, wealth, transient pleasures, praise, and reputation, we may deprive ourselves of the reality of living well. The reason we don't devote more time to balancing our minds is that we are betting our lives that we can find the happiness we seek by chasing fleeting pleasures. Psychologists have called this the hedonic treadmill, and the first step to escaping from this exhausting grind is to seek a vision of genuine happiness that draws on our own largely untapped inner resources. This is how we begin to cultivate loving kindness, first for ourselves and then for all those around us. So we're going to do a short meditation now, cultivating this loving kindness, primarily for ourselves and then extending it out to others. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. An act of loving kindness for yourself. Allow your awareness to descend into the body. Simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath, to relax and release and tightness of tension in any part of the body. entire body to become completely relaxed, completely ease. The breathing to flow naturally, effortlessly. Not trying to manipulate the breath in any way. Each out breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing. Setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes. We can begin by cultivating loving kindness towards ourselves, and then we can extend it out to others. And we can begin this by reflecting on 4 points. The first point that we can reflect on is, what are the deepest aspirations in your life? What is your heart's desire? What do you really want to achieve in this life? picture your deepest aspirations very clearly. No matter how much mental afflictions, such as anger, jealousy, craving, fear and anxiety, no matter how much of these mental afflictions are in our mind, they are just like dirt covering the surface of our mind. And underneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind. This natural purity of our mind is sometimes called Buddha nature. Our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So imagine this inner purity of your mind in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest at the level of your heart. Arouse the thought, may I realize the genuine happiness that is my heart's desire. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light filling and saturating your entire body and mind. Imagining that your deepest aspirations are being fulfilled here and now. the second point that we can reflect on is, what would you love to receive from the people around you in the world at large? What forms of friendship, guidance, and material assistance do you need to fulfill your highest aspirations? Arounds the thought, may I receive all that I need to find the genuine happiness that I seek. And then with each in-breath, imagine reality rising up in the form of white light, streaming in from all directions, providing you with everything you need. The help that we receive from the world around us is not enough for us to realize the genuine happiness that we seek. This inner transformation is essential. So the third point to reflect on is, how would you love to transform and evolve as a human being? What faults would you like to be free of? And what qualities would you like to develop in order to find that genuine happiness? And arouse the thought, may I cultivate true causes of my own fulfillment. And with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out in a sphere of light everywhere, saturating your body and mind. Imagining that you're evolving into the person that you would love to be here and now. finally, the fourth point to reflect on is, for the sake of your own fulfillment, and in order to make your life as meaningful as possible, what would you truly love to offer to the world? With each out-breath, imagine measurable rays of light radiating out from your heart in all directions, actualizing this offering to the world here and now. Release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply allow the mind to rest in the present moment. Resting in awareness itself. Taking anything as an object. Simply being aware of being aware. What I'd like to do now is try to clarify some confusion about the difference between loving kindness, which is what we've been reflecting on here, and what's called attachment. Because often here there's a lot of confusion regarding particularly these two things. Because from a Buddhist perspective, this word attachment here, which is a translation of Sanskrit word raga, attachment is one of the mental afflictions that we have in our mind that actually create a lot of suffering for us. And so from a Buddhist perspective, attachment is something that we need to eliminate fully. Whereas, of course, loving kindness is a positive quality that we are trying to cultivate towards ourselves and others. But then often there's confusion regarding these two words from a number of areas. First off, with this word attachment, we talk about eliminating attachment. It's a mental affliction that we need to eliminate. But then often people, when they hear this, they think, well, if I get rid of my attachment, isn't my life going to be very boring? You know, because I sort of need attachment to enjoy the simple pleasures in life. That if I get rid of attachment, everything will just become bland and boring in my life. Actually, the reality is exactly the opposite. It's attachment now that actually interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. You know, this temporal pleasures, temporal happiness that we talked about. It's when we have attachment to this type of happiness, these pleasures, that actually creates problems for us. Because we know from our own experience, if we have strong craving and attachment for something, then our mind is quite agitated, which means that even when we have that object of pleasure, because our mind is full of attachment, is very agitated, we're not really even fully enjoying that experience because we're maybe worried about not getting enough of it or coming to an end and so forth. And also, of course, if we don't get that object of our attachment, we often have a lot of frustration. And when that experience finishes, because of the attachment, then often we have a lot of dissatisfaction and disappointment that it's come to an end. So actually our attachment interferes with our enjoyment of the simple pleasures in life. And if we get rid of attachment, then we will enjoy things in life much more. Because if we don't have attachment, that doesn't mean, of course, we'll stop enjoying the things we enjoy in life. It means without the attachment, our mind will be much more calm and peaceful, which means when we're having that experience, it won't be agitated, we won't be worried about not getting enough or it coming to an end. And so then actually we can be fully present with the enjoyment of that sense pleasure. And so actually we will enjoy that sense pleasure more than we do now. And of course if we don't get that sense pleasure, then we won't have a lot of frustration. And when it comes to an end, we won't be disappointed. We'll simply enjoy it while it's there fully. Also, what we find with attachment is that attachment is always looking for something bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. And we know from our own experience that sometimes there's certain things we enjoy, but if we have that object of enjoyment too much, after a while attachment goes, oh, that's boring now. Give me something bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. So actually attachment causes us to not enjoy the things that sometimes we used to enjoy because attachment's not satisfied with that anymore. It wants something bigger, better and different all the time. So actually we miss out on the simple pleasures in life because of that. And that was very much highlighted to me the first time I did a long meditation retreat. I was in a place in Spain and the retreat center was offering meals. I don't really like to cook for myself in retreat. And generally in the retreat centers, the meals are quite wholesome. but they tend to be a fairly standard menu each week. And so, of course, if we eat the same food every week, then very quickly we become bored with it. Even if it's can be our favourite food, if we eat it all the time, after some time our attachment goes, oh, not that again. Give me something different. You know, I don't want that again. So my, and that's, the menu was the same, pretty well the same menu every week. But what I found was after some weeks, I didn't find that happening. I didn't find after 3 or 4 weeks going, oh, not that again. What I found was that the food started tasting better. And I thought, what's going on here? I thought, wow, the cook's really putting more effort into their cooking. They're really adding more herbs and spices and really taking much more care now than they did a few weeks ago. But actually, after some more weeks, I realized, no, it's exactly the same food. And I thought, what's going on? And what was going on was, because of the time spent in retreat, my craving and attachment was subsiding, was dropping down. Which meant that because of less and less craving and attachment, I was actually enjoying that food more and more and not being filtered through the attachment which goes, oh no, no, that's not tasty enough, that's not good enough, I want something better, 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 better. So actually I found week after week the food started tasting better. And also I found that the environment became more beautiful. I mean, I was in quite a nice place with a really nice view, but of course, again, even if we're in a place where there's a nice view, but we're there every day, day after day after day, after some time we go, that's pretty boring now. But actually, that's, I found the opposite. I found that everything started to be more vibrant, more beautiful, even very small things were like amazing. And that's again because attachment was dropping down. So this is my experience and experience of many other people as well. So if we actually reduce our attachment, we will actually find that we'll enjoy the simple pleasures in life much more than we do now. So that's one point about attachment. And then sometimes people can go, I can sort of maybe understand that. But when it comes to a relationship, then definitely I need attachment. Because if I don't have attachment, I wouldn't be able to even have a relationship. But again, this is completely the opposite. And here, part of the problem or difficulty comes from the word attachment itself. Within Buddhism, the word attachment is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, it exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess the object. Hold the object. Why? Because attachment believes that object is the source of our happiness. Whereas loving kindness is very different. So often people feel like attachment and loving kindness are more or less the same thing. That if they get rid of attachment, then they won't be able to even have any sort of loving kindness or relationship. And again, part of the difficulty here comes from terminology. Particularly this word attachment. Because this word attachment, how it's used in psychology is a little bit different than how it's used here in Buddhism. You know, we sometimes see in psychology this sort of attachment theory. And we talk about, actually, there are healthy forms of attachment we need to actively cultivate. You know, often the example given is this strong bond between mother and child. That we need to actively cultivate that, otherwise it's very unhealthy. And so in psychology, that is a form of attachment. But here, the word attachment in psychology is defined quite differently than what we've just seen here in Buddhism. In fact, I've got a definition of the word attachment here in psychology. It's an enduring emotional tie to a special person characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition of attachment in psychology is it's a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause, or the like. Another definition of attachment in psychology is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for the word attachment in psychology is affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. So it seems like the word attachment has quite a positive flavor in psychology, and that there are actually healthy forms of attachment we need to actively cultivate. But of course, also in psychology, there are unhealthy forms of attachment we need to overcome. But here, how the word attachment is used in Buddhism is very different to this. And that this strong, for example, this strong bond between mother and child would not be called attachment in Buddhism. So again, attachment is this mental factor that sees something as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object, believing it to be the source of our happiness. So actually, in a relationship, then we have generally both of these operating. We usually have some loving kindness and attachment. They seem to be one thing, but actually there's usually two dynamics going on in any relationship. The healthy part of the relationship is the loving kindness, which is simply the wish for that person to be happy. And of course, the fine print there is without expecting anything in return, what we would call unconditional love, no strings attached love. So strings attached love is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like, you know, I will love you as long as, and here comes the condition, as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. I'll love you that long. So that, of course, is attachment speaking. So in a relationship, attachment is all about me, 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 me. And attachment actually sees the other person as an object to satisfy me. So we need to really distinguish these two dynamics. And to really to distinguish them more easily, love in a relationship or loving kindness is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So attachment's all about me, 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 me. So therefore, if in a relationship we can reduce the attachment and increase the love or loving kindness, then we can have a more healthy relationship. Now, often in Buddhism, we hear, and particularly here when we talk about immeasurable loving kindness, often you'll hear within Buddhism, they're saying, you know, we should love everyone equally. And then often there's some confusion about this. And again, part of the problem is the term, the word. Because the word love in our English language, love, of course, is an emotion, and it also usually implies some sort of intimate behavior. Whereas here, loving kindness, or in Sanskrit, maitri, in Pali, and metta, these words is not an emotion. It's an aspiration. So remember, loving kindness, or maitri, or metta, is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Is the wish for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes. So therefore it's better to translate maitri and metta as loving kindness rather than as love. Because loving kindness here is not even an emotion, it's an aspiration, it's a wish for ourselves and others to have happiness in its causes. So in Buddhism, when you hear people say to love everyone equally, we're not talking about having the same sort of behavior and spending the same amount of time with everyone. This would be a disaster. Rather, when we say to love everyone equally, we're talking about the same attitude, that we're trying to cultivate the equal attitude of wishing everyone equally to be happy. That's what we mean. And then how we would express that loving kindness would completely depend on the relationship we had with the person. We would express that loving kindness to our partner in a very intimate way and spend a lot of time with them. We would express that same loving kindness with our family members and friends in a very different way. And we would express that same loving kindness to our work colleagues and other people in the street in a very different way and maybe hardly spend any time with them.
But we're talking about the equal attitude, not the equal behavior. So that's something very important to understand. And then one more point, and that is that sometimes then people think that, okay, maybe I understand that actually in relationships there are these two dynamics going on, and I need to distinguish the healthy part of the love or loving kindness. I need to distinguish the attachment from that and try to reduce attachment as much as possible and increase the loving kindness as much as possible. But still, I need attachment because I'm a creative person. And if I don't have attachment, I can't be creative. So again, this is completely the opposite. Yes, it's true that mental afflictions such as attachment and craving and anger and jealousy provide a lot of fuel for creativity. I mean, how much art and music has been done and performed through using that as fuel. But of course, we're talking here about the source of creativity. Our mental afflictions is not the source of creativity. The source of creativity, of course, is coming from deep within our own mind. And as long as our mind is agitated by mental afflictions such as anger and jealousy and attachment, we're suffocating our creativity. So if we start to eliminate these mental afflictions such as attachment, creativity can become come through more and more. And also now, often we tend to be a bit creative for a bit of a selfish motivation, you know, wanting to show off to others how wonderful a musician or artist we are. Whereas if we reduce and eliminate our mental afflictions, not only will we become more creative, but we'll become more creative for a better purpose. That we'll start to use our creative talents not as a an ego display, but rather to benefit others. So if we can reduce these mental afflictions, we'll become more creative and we'll use our creative talents to really benefit society in a more meaningful way. So therefore, whether we're talking about enjoying the simple pleasures in life, whether we're talking about our relationships or being creative, if we reduce and eliminate attachment, then all of those areas will improve. We'll enjoy simple pleasures in life more, our relationships will improve more, and we'll become more creative for a more meaningful way. So that's a few things I thought would be helpful to mention in terms of attachment and then also this loving kindness that we had a look at in this session. Okay, there now it's 3 o'clock, so it's time for afternoon tea break. So let's have a 30-minute break, and then at 3:30 we'll come back and we'll go back into our shamatha practice there.